I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Hello, and welcome to another Damn Fine Espresso, and another in our lost summer season. And for this episode, we're going back to probably the biggest loss in cinema in recent times, David Lynch. And joining me on today's episode is Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hey there, Alan.
And this espresso is sort of a follow-up to our recent discussion of Wild at Heart. I think we enjoyed rediscovering and rewatching that movie. So we've done pretty much the same, but with David Lynch's 1997 film, Lost Highway. So I think I'll start with a very similar question to last time. When did you first see Lost Highway, and what was your thoughts about it at the time?
Lost Highway was one of the three David Lynch films that I saw over and over again in the 90s. For listeners of our previous episode, it was my sister's favorite director, and we kind of co-introduced each other to our favorite movies. I, you know, put her to the entire James Bond series, and she showed me the David Lynch films that were available or that she liked. So it was Wild at Heart, it was Blue Velvet, and it was Lost Highway, which was pretty new at the time. It had come out in 97, and I think this must have been in 98, maybe, when we watched it. And it's probably the one David Lynch movie that I've seen the most times. We watched it over and over again, and I remember there were so many ways of trying to, you know, make sense of it and discuss it and go into the piece of music and individual scenes. And it's really one, now also rewatching it, that I felt I'm very familiar with, but it was still a good experience seeing it again after quite a while. How about you with Lost Highway? Did you see it when it came out at cinemas?
Yeah, no, I remember seeing it pretty much when it came out and enjoying it. And there was sort of a weird experience in that I think I did like it. And then Mulholland Drive came along not too much later and kind of eclipsed it. And so there was a long period of time where that was the David Lynch film. That was very much the late 90s. The very polished David Lynch film was Mulholland Drive. And Lost Highway sort of disappeared a little bit as sort of a reference point. It wasn't one that I'd race to rewatch in a way that I would often just, if Mulholland Drive was on, I would make the effort to go and see it. It was a film I knew I'd enjoyed, but I hadn't seen for a long time. And it was like really, really fun to sort of come back and watch it again this time. I think to realize that it's a very good film.
It is. And I just realized how much it fell into that period, you know, when I was turning 18. It's one of those, you know, coming of age films to me. It was one of those darkest films I had ever seen. And I think in the context of the other David Lynch films, it really also stuck out. I remember even having little, you know, movie posters and pictures from the film that I would still glue into my kind of diary scrapbook. And there were pieces of music, especially the David Bowie song at the beginning and the end of the film, I'm Deranged, that I would play over and over again and had on my playlist and my mixtapes together with, you know, Rammstein and all these, like, bits and pieces that are somehow linked to Lost Highway. And so it was a very influential film, apparently, to me and at this point in my life.
I think it's interesting, probably just being a few years older than you are, that probably I was just that little bit more jaded. I wasn't quite a teenager anymore. I sort of enjoyed it, but then moved on. It didn't have a similar impact. And actually, it's really interesting that having not seen it for so long, I had no recollection of just how much of a 90s film this looks. This really feels of the time. And I guess you need a bit of time to get to a stage where you notice it. But I think not just the music, but the look, the aesthetic, it is such a mid-90s film. And I had no recollection of that. I've sort of felt, oh, it's a modern noir. It's probably going to be sort of sleazy and like seductive and surreal. And it's all those things, but it's also incredibly 90s pop culture. There's a whole load of sort of mid-90s, sort of slightly sexy noir films. I'm thinking of films like The Last Seduction and stuff like that. Like the 90s was the last time that Hollywood, I think, really sort of engaged in having big films that would dare to have a bit of sex in them. But there's a very 90s way of doing sex. And this feels so of its time in a way that you don't normally associate with David Lynch.
Yeah, I also feel it's one of those films, or maybe the film where he placed himself most in the time in which the film was made. You know, I mean, there were songs from other eras in Blue Velvet, obviously also the more historic songs than Blue Velvet included. Here it seems really much he's at his hippest, right? This is David Lynch on the, I don't know, the pinnacle of his career. I can't say that because it was a bit of a slump after Twin Peaks second season, from what I read, and also getting a movie done. I think there was a 5-year gap between Twin Peaks and Lost Highway. And I think Wild at Heart hadn't done very well at the box office either. But I feel this is really where he came back to this late 90s point in time, right? And he sticks so much of the music and, as you say, the aesthetics and the feel of this moment in time into the film. So yeah, watching it, it feels very much of that point in time.
And I think it's weird, especially watching it in conjunction with all the other films, in a way that, you know, something like Blue Velvet, I think the odd haircut aside, it doesn't feel dated to when it was made. I think there's a couple of haircuts that feel very 80s in that. But apart from that, it feels quite disorientating and timeless. And I will admit, there's some moments in this which I'm not sure they're intentionally funny. There's the scene where we learn that Bill Pullman's character is a saxophonist, and we go to him in this like nightclub, and he's playing this very... And it's the way he's playing saxophone, and it seems to take it very seriously, which is a very 90s vibe, that like musicians were sexy, saxophone musicians are really sexy. But he's a really serious one, and it hits you with this scene. And I don't know whether it was, I don't remember people laughing in the 90s, but it just seemed so silly. It seemed like such a sort of 90s film, this sort of serious, sexy saxophone. You could not show that in a film now. And it was this sort of crazy moment of, yeah, just of its time. And I think sometimes the soundtrack does that a little bit at times.
I felt the same way about the scene where the Rammstein song is playing. You know, we're at this villa, and obviously there is this task that our second protagonist has to fulfill in that villa. And there's this big screen of pornography playing, you know, all repeated movements. I won't go into details. And this Rammstein song is playing. So I remember at the time this was, you know, quite impressive, and obviously Rammstein really had this edge and this very bizarre sound, especially if you came from understanding German. But this just struck me as not funny, but just odd, this combination, and then this, you know, supposedly very dark moment. And I felt this is also probably something that stuck out much more in the 90s as probably a daring moment, you know. Juxtaposition of the song and the porn on the screen and the dark deeds that are going to follow. There was something quite, yeah, again, of its time, I felt.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing I think there was probably quite a lot more power in the song then when it was new, whereas I think now it's been used in other things. You recognize it the moment it starts, not as the impact it has in the scene. You recognize it as, oh, that's that famous song. You know, there's a lot of times in this that you sort of feel, oh, I know this song. This is a 90s song. This sounds very 90s. And I think obviously at the time, it would have just felt, oh, this sounds really interesting. This sounds, the impact in the scene would have been to like catch you as a feeling of the moment, as a sort of slightly countercultural sound of the time. Whereas now it feels a lot more mainstream. It feels a lot more, oh yeah, those are the tunes that are still famous today. But I mean, that's not meant to be overly critical. It just is sort of quite interesting because I don't remember it feeling 90s, which is obviously on me. It's obviously going back to something and suddenly realizing this is a long period of time. This is nearly like 30 years ago. We're now watching this film. Of course it's going to feel of its time.
Yeah, it fits. It fits. It fits the moment. I think we're so used to having David Lynch refer back to especially the 50s with, you know, the hairstyles and the clothes and the music. And here I think the only older piece of music is probably the How Insensitive, when Baltasar Getty sits in the garden and this bossa nova tune is playing. That feels the most, you know, David Lynchy of harking back to the 50s and 60s. And I think everything else as you say, is pretty either neutral or could be read as kind of a 90s revamp of, you know, the leather jacket and the pixie hairstyles. And, you know, growing up in the 90s, of course, for instance, my cousins, they were all dressed like that. They all drove the old cars that are in this movie. So to me, at the time, at least, it didn't feel like a retro movie at all. It was just like very, you know, hip, very what I saw around me in that certain bubble of people who were listening to Marilyn Manson and Rammstein and were dressing. I mean, my sister included, she looked almost exactly like Patricia Arquette in her first incarnation for a while. So this was really depressing to me. And I think that's maybe a little different from Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive that seem very nostalgic in their setting, and obviously Twin Peaks as well in this like 1950s suburbia mashup. And here that's not really the case. It's edgier and more of that point in time.
And I think it's probably interesting that like we're relating to this as a 90s thing, reflecting on our youth. And then you suddenly sort of think, with a lot of the other films, that's going to be when he's using the older music. Like you said, he's referencing the 50s. That was 30 years before that time. So obviously his generation probably had quite a different reaction to the tunes they're using in Mulholland Drive. That would have felt to them like we're responding to these tunes. But I really just enjoyed this film, watching it again and to some extent rediscovering it. There was bits of it I did not remember seeing previously. And I think probably sort of cut to the chase of what really hit me this time that I'd never really spotted or I didn't remember previously is near the end when the sort of Patricia Arquette Mark II whispers into the ear, "You'll never have me," to the guy. And suddenly that feels like such a pivotal thing in the film that I did not sort of remember from the first viewing. I think I was probably just along for the ride. And then suddenly I think watching it now and sort of seeing so much the jealousy, seeing so much the sort of suppressed violence and then obviously the actual violence, the notion that characters you're following that are pleading innocence and seem to think they are innocent are not innocent. There is a darkness underneath it. Suddenly that this is like the pivotal moment that the woman is saying to the main character, "You'll never have me." So it really felt like it unlocked the film. And I had no recollection of that.
Mm-hmm. It is similar to me in the sense that I did remember very well the first third of the film, roughly, you know, the whole setup of Bill Pullman and Patricia Arquette in their modernist, brutalist house, receiving those videotapes and watching them. And then obviously the mystery man, this very, very iconic scene early in the film. That I remembered almost like scene by scene. This is such a classic build up until the moment then when he lands in prison and he supposedly killed his wife, we're not quite sure. And then, of course, the identity switch happens to Baltasar Getty. And I think from that point on, the movie was a bit of a blur. And I realized that I actually did not remember where this was going. I remembered, obviously, that Patricia Arquette would show up as her blonde second incarnation, Mr. Eddie. These scenes I remembered more in bits and pieces, but I really did not see you then, especially where the second switch comes in and where the whole thing around, you know, Bill Pullman versus Baltasar Getty, these two characters start to make sense. I had forgotten how much, in a way, the film makes sense if you understand it from the point of view of jealousy and, you know, this creeping feeling of someone is betraying me and I'm deeply distrustful and I'm beside myself with my emotions and somehow I'm making a lot up around what really happened. And I think, you know, so many people say, well, the movie does not make sense. But I think seen from that point of view, at least in one version, one interpretation, it does make a lot of sense on an emotional level. And you can really imagine that Bill Pullman somehow dissolved in his emotion and this, you know, sublimated guilt, feelings of guilt, and becomes the second character. So I think I also saw it, maybe it's more of the adult movie than we thought, you know, seeing it in our teenage, maybe there is something to say about the fact that maybe we didn't quite get what the movie was all about. And seeing it now, it definitely makes more sense.
I mean, I thought it was very interesting that, like, obviously since seeing it last time and in preparation for you watching it, I was doing a bit of a dive onto, like, David Lynch interviews, which I've generally been doing in part of the bin. And I saw a very good interview where he sort of mentioned about one of the inspirations was learning about this condition called, I think it was called like psychogenic fugue.
Exactly, yeah.
Where someone who commits a terrible crime can kind of convince themselves they haven't. They go into a mental state that is in absolute denial that they've done it, and this sort of fugue state. And I think that, knowing that, makes it a very, very interesting film. Just, you know, the change of character, that this sort of like switch as to who he is, comes with this idea of how does the Pullman character come to terms with the fact that maybe he's killed Patricia Arquette. Is he just denies who he is and sort of becomes someone else, becomes someone younger, becomes someone sexier, becomes someone far more capable and successful in some respects than he is, that this is where he sort of mentally comes from. And I think, like you said, I think watching it now as more adult, there's adult aspects like that I sort of watching it really appreciated.
And I think, you know, in addition to that, also the way that Lynch has put this into a film visually, structurally, thematically, I think it is very successful. I think the whole idea of doubling characters and splitting characters, and the mystery man serving as a kind of, you know, truth teller within that one world, and then the characters showing up again, slowly seeping into that second version of the film. I think the whole, if you can say, the whole Lynch puzzle piece here, and the way he's aligned all these things to make sense. I think in Lost Highway, really, I felt this time around, they really fall into place. This feels like a whole, together with, you know, we talked about the arc that leads from the beginning to the end of Blue Velvet, you know, the picket fence, and this kind of like, which seems a little tacked on, a little strange to loop it back to this fairy tale ending. But here, I think the whole idea of the Lost Highway itself, the imagery of the street, the different images of the burning house, and the beginning to the end, the conclusions it draws, it seems to fall into place. That's why I say it makes sense, even though plot-wise, if you told that to someone, it doesn't make sense at all. But the way it's arranged and shown, and the way it feels, this feels like a complete conclusion. That's something that comes full circle somehow.
And I do sort of like, you know, you've got quite the big twist, and it's a twist very similar to Mulholland Drive, the sort of the universe seems to switch and someone isn't who you thought it is. And it does that switch quite early on in the film. And actually, rewatching Lost Highway, I started watching it thinking, I wonder if I can kind of, to some extent, work this out. What's going on with this? And I very quickly just stopped caring about working it out. I think there is something very enjoyable. And there's something similar with Mulholland Drive. There's all the sort of, people give all the explanations about, oh, this bit's a dream, this bit isn't a dream. But I think the more I watch it, the more I like not trying to unlock it like a puzzle piece. And to just sort of experience it. And, you know, there's a lot of theories online about Bill Pullman's character goes to prison, and then this whole film is his fantasy before he gets, like, on the electric chair. And, you know, you can read it one way. But I read a really good, interesting take on it by Patricia Arquette, where her interpretation of the film is that it's very much about the way men get away with violence. You know, he has killed his wife, but actually society is able to sort of let him be a new person and go on and to some extent repeat the same thing over again. And so her view on it was, you know, this isn't a dream. This is something about how men can be jealous and violent. And there's an interesting level of societal acceptance of that.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Also in the context of like the O.J. Simpson years, you know,
yeah,
kind of this, obviously not the same case, but somehow in the wake of that, this would make a lot of sense.
And again, I thought you don't need to sort of look at it and think, right, what does this scene mean for that interpretation? That it's really enjoyable. And I think Lost Highway, by getting its big twist in early, sort of stops you having to care about trying to fit the puzzle box together. You can just enjoy what's happening. Maybe enjoy is the wrong word, but you can sort of experience what's happening. The mystery man reappears. You've got the odd gangster boss that sort of starts as a like comedy gangster boss. And then as the film progresses, you really realize he's really unpleasant. And then you have like who's going to be killed, the nature of death and everything. All this stuff, like, it just is really effective as like an experience.
Yeah, I have to say enjoy is probably a good word here. I think I really enjoyed it for its pure darkness. You know, I think even in Mulholland Drive and in Twin Peaks especially, there is a lot of also comical elements, a lot of relief as well, something that is also genuinely warm. And I feel Lost Highway is really fine-tuned to be a cold,
yes,
uncompromising experience, from the soundtrack to the imagery to Bill Pullman, as you know, cast so much against his usual characters that he played around the time, this romantic or heroic lead. And here, together with his saxophone playing that you mentioned before, it's so harsh, it's so like edgy and jarring. And both Patricia Arquette characters are dubious. The gangsters obviously are dubious. The little small side characters are. There's really nothing really rewarding in this film, in the sense of, you know, there are good sides to it. There are hopeful aspects to it. It really takes this ride into darkness. And I think one of the parts that I enjoy the most is this first third inside the house, you know, the dark corridors, the edginess of the house itself. I think, you know, Lynch, together with some of my other favorite directors, had a knack for architecture. And I think we talked about movie architecture in other podcasts. And I think here, this is one of my favorite examples of his films, where he uses a space to tell this first part of the story, the different spaces, the different alleys, the different light and darkness inside, outside of the house is so memorable. And I think it's really a film to enjoy for the pull into darkness, both visually, musically, and thematically.
And there's such an amazing scene in that first third, where just before things go really wild, you have sort of Patricia Arquette in the house staring into a corridor into absolute darkness. And it just imbues the whole film with this quality of being, you know, even if you haven't seen it before, you know something bad is going to happen. But on the rewatch, it feels even bigger, like, because you do know something really bad is going to happen. And that sort of staring into a void, into the architecture, is just, it's brilliantly done.
It's enormously effective as a film still. I thought, you know, just that one moment that you mentioned here, that the staring into darkness, is still very scary, even if you know what's going to happen in the film. But I think just as a basic setup of having this character look down the corridor and or at the winding around the bends within the house, I still felt that sense of dread that I originally felt when I watched the movie. It's very still unpredictable, despite knowing generally what happens. But it really put me through that haunted house ride again, in a way, without the, you know, the fun attached. You don't quite know how you're going to get out. And as I had forgotten how the film actually ends and progresses in the second half, it did feel again that, you know, disconcerting. And I thought, oh, how is that going to fit at the end? And then once he reaches his house again and, you know, speaks these famous lines that come up at the beginning, I thought, oh yeah, exactly, that's how the last puzzle piece fits. But it's still an unpredictable fun ride, fun in quotation marks here.
And I think another sort of illustration that it has that I think I really enjoyed is it's got like David Lynch's mastery of, I wouldn't almost say like horror film tropes, because not many other films do them, but it has these brilliant moments of like, this is going to capture something that scares and unsettles you. So at the beginning, you've got, they realize they're being watched and they don't know by who. So you have these sort of videotapes of the house and who does it mean? And then that idea is sort of reinvented when Bill Pullman's character just goes, well, I don't like videoing things, I prefer to remember it, which seems like quite a key part of this film, that he's so hostile to being videoed because he'd rather remember a more palatable truth. But just the notion of a videotape watching you when you don't know you're being watched, that's like pure unsettling material. And there's another lovely moment when he meets the mystery man at the party and he says, well, I'm in your house at the moment, call up and I will answer. And so the person in front of you, who looks creepy, has an amazing look on his face, like how they do him up with no eyebrows, answers the phone. I think there is something brilliantly, fundamentally horrifying and unsettling. And like David Lynch can just pull these off and they just always work. And you rewatch it and it works. It's like going back to a good ghost story. The chill is still there. And I thought that was like another brilliant part of rewatching it.
I remember really being like utterly scared at these parts of the film. Like both things that you describe here were really among my most horror idea of a film setup, right? Because it is set in so-called reality here. It's not an obvious horror film, but by using these tropes, I think, in a thriller that really then verges into horror, and you don't quite know where it's going and what of it is actually or has actually happened. I felt reminded of another 70s film that I really like, When a Stranger Calls, that has these like first very scary 20 minutes around the phone call. And the phone always rings again and again. And the rest of the film is not really that good. But the first 20 minutes, that's also been remade in the 2000s, I think, are so effective. And it's a very simple setup. But these first 20 minutes are some of the scariest bits in film. Also the way, you know, the sound works and the editing and the way the camera moves around the house. There's definitely some similarity to that, to a very, very good psycho thriller moment. And I think here he uses it to perfection. I think it's such a great setup.
And I think the just a sort of one thing as well, you sort of mentioned the sort of final, the famous line that, you know, Dick Laurent is dead. It occurs at the beginning and it occurs at the end. And again, what I've really sort of enjoyed in this sort of binge is discovering a bit more about it and discovering that this is something that happened to Lynch as well. That
yes,
apparently someone pressed his door and left that message. And then when he raced, there was no one there. And it sort of seeded into his brain. And I remember you sort of saying when we discussed Blue Velvet about how the sort of naked woman at the front of the house was something that had happened to David Lynch when he was young. And all these sort of moments that I just find it interesting to just consider that something would happen to a mind like David Lynch. And then he minds it to produce a really good film. And there's something sort of beautiful, you know, learning more doesn't give away the secret. It just makes you admire him more, that something like this happened and he thought, that's a bit weird. And the interview I saw kind of gave a little bit of a, I think he did realize there was a bit of an explanation that it probably was a message for the neighbor. That he realized that the name probably, but just that initial unsettling, you know, this thing comes to you as a message, Dick Laurent is dead. And then his brain goes, right, I can do something with that. And then it gives us Lost Highway is incredibly enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think it's also kind of in a nutshell why people love David Lynch, who love David Lynch, because he has that, he taps into something that is probably more like dream logic, right? Hearing some random sentence or thinking about this idea of the Lost Highway, which I think he picked from a poem that he liked and then wanted to kind of follow up on that and then visualizes it. So I think there's something very subconscious and something very dreamlike about, I guess, a lot of Lynch cinema. But I feel here it really is all in the open because it has this sudden break that could only happen in dreams, right? When suddenly we're changing character and we're completely somebody else in the prison cell and the story takes an entirely completely different turn and twists into, with the same characters or similar characters, twists into a completely new direction. So I think here he taps into something very fundamental that I think if you break through the darkness and break through the initial lack of logic as it seems on the surface, I think this then becomes really one of the most worthwhile dive into Lynch's logic and world. I mean, I love most of his films, but this one really had such a, again, such a satisfying outcome for me.
Definitely. Like I said, I think it's lived in the sort of shadow of Mulholland Drive in my memory, because that was the film that really got me in the cinema. And I think I've really sort of enjoyed coming back and realizing that there is so much to enjoy in here. And it's a fascinating film. It's got the qualities I really like in Mulholland Drive are actually in this film. He was playing in that area. And I think it's definitely one that I will be far more inclined to be chasing a rewatch if it's on the big screen, much as I do with Mulholland Drive. You know, it's gone up on my table. I mean, all the films are high up on the table, but it's gone up the league of just like, yeah, this is a really good film.
Yeah, and I think you were right in saying it at the beginning that Mulholland Drive somehow eclipsed this film because it was so well received. It was really seen as, you know, the best Lynch since, I don't know, Blue Velvet probably by many. And then it was voted as one of the best films of the 21st century a couple of times recently. So in a way, this really outshone what Lost Highway had done. But in a way, Lost Highway is like, it's almost like a different grape variety. If you know, compare wines, if you want something that is perfect in that vein, you know, with that taste, with that dark fruits, I don't know, the analogies escape me, but you know what I mean. It's like Mulholland Drive is a great vintage and fantastic and probably one of the best that this Lynch ever produced, but boy is Lost Highway something of a different kind that is done perfectly.
Yeah.
And has a very different flavor to it, but you still have to see it within the context of Lynch.
Yeah, and definitely worth going back to if you, like me, haven't seen it for a while.
Absolutely.
But I think all that talk of wine has made me thirsty, so I think we're going to head off and grab ourselves a few nice glasses of wine. But thanks everyone for listening to another Damn Fine Espresso, and thanks for talking David Lynch with me, Sam.
Of course, pleasure always. We should go on with that.
And join us next time for another Damn Fine Cup of Culture and Damn Fine Espresso.
Bye-bye.